Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Bree Buchanan, and Bree is the Senior Advisor at Krill Strategies. Welcome to the show, Bree.
Oh, thanks so much, Todd and Jody. I'm just delighted to be here.
We're very excited to have you, especially in honor of Mental Health Awareness Month. Right. And so we do intend to get this episode produced and released during the month of May. And we're just super excited to have you on to talk about the topics in which you happen to be an expert. Okay. Before we launch in, if you would maybe let's talk a little about your background. You are a lawyer.
Absolutely.
And a lot of folks here in Texas will know your name for reasons that we will get into before too long. But let's talk about who you are and where you come from.
You bet. So Texas born and bred. I've been a lawyer for 33 years. And I went to UT Law and graduated from there in 89 and got what at my time was that time was my dream job. I started out legal aid in Austin back when it was Legal Aid Society of Central Texas. Did domestic violence work. And then went from there to have my own office. For all of you folks, the listeners who are solo practitioners, I feel your pain. I could do it for 54 weeks and I threw in the towel. That was the hardest thing, having your own office. And then I got to go up from the front lines and then get into the ivory tower of policy and the think tank world about domestic violence, and went to the Texas Council on Family Violence, did lobbying for a number of years, and then got pulled back to UT Law and was the clinical director for the Children's Rights Clinic. So that was a tough time. I went from years of representing domestic violence victims to representing children, family violence, and kids in the foster care, which is certainly an experience that took its toll on me and really ended up with a shift in my life. I got to the point where the things that I was doing to cope with the stress and the difficulties and just the existential pain of living with representing those folks in those kinds of cases. And, you know, my story is out there. I ended up self-medicating with alcohol, developing an alcohol use disorder. And then when I got into recovery 13 years ago, it really changed my life. And I went to work at the State Bar's Texas Lawyers Assistance Program and was there for 10 years and ultimately became the director. So I've got to do just about anything you can think of, I think, for the law degree over the course of my career. And so spent that time at TLAP helping Texas lawyers with, you know, I'd speak to hundreds of lawyers a year who were experiencing all kinds of types of distress. From maybe it's a substance use issue, but also depression and anxiety and burnout and lack of purpose and meaning in their careers. So that really set me on a path to be able to take care of my own well-being because I was working on it with other people all the time. And then got me to where I am now, working with Krill Strategies and the Institute for Well-Being and Law. And so it's been an amazing career path for me. Some bumps, but amazing. In and of itself.
I think probably most of our listeners are familiar with TLAP, but would you mind kind of giving the quick elevator pitch for what they are and what they do?
You bet. So the Texas Lawyers Assistance Program provides supportive services and resources to law students, lawyers, and judges who are currently in the state of Texas. And so when somebody calls, they will get one of the staff members. The conversation is confidential by statute. It can be anonymous if you're concerned, and you'd be calling to explore if you are having struggles yourself, or as well, if there's somebody you know and care about who is also struggling. So you can call for those two different purposes. And the folks at TLAP, the people who are experts in this area, will give you resources, connect you with behavioral health supports, et cetera. So it's a real sort of one-stop shop for the legal profession in Texas to find out and get connected with the resources they may need in the behavioral health arena.
How long had TLAP been going when you first joined?
I think it was already in existence at least 20 years.
Okay.
Mike Crowley was one of the originators.
Right.
Maybe a name that rings a bell. Yeah.
It does. Well, one thing you mentioned, the confidential nature of it and being able to be anonymous if someone calling chooses to be. And, you know, we're going to talk a lot about the current mindset of lawyers when it comes to well-being as we have this conversation. But I just thought I would go ahead and throw out there that and just emphasize the confidential nature of it, because I've heard lawyers talk over the years about, well, no, you have to be careful because TLAP is really the state bar. And I know that to not be true. I know, you know, it's important, I think, to emphasize that, yes, TLAP is funded by the state bar and lawyers' bar dues, but there is an absolute wall of communication between the state bar and the folks who work for TLAP. And there information does not flow from TLAP to the state bar. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. And there is a literal wall and a figurative wall. Our offices are in the bar, but we're behind double locked doors. No one has access to our database where we keep our resources. It is a closed system. We do not take identifying information from people who call. And if somebody wants to call and not give their name or give any identifying information, that's absolutely fine. We can provide services anonymously. So if somebody is just not completely convinced that it is going to be the data or information will be secure, well, just simply don't give us your name. And they can still help you. So yeah, I think that the Lawyers Assistance Program community across the country is exquisitely aware. If there is any concern about the anonymity of a caller, people just won't call. So the Lawyers Assistance Programs, the LAPs, have bent over backwards to make sure that there is true anonymity and confidentiality, and that we do everything we can to make people believe that and feel that they can call and speak with anonymity as well.
I'm glad to have you on to be able to speak to that, mm-hmm. because I want to dispel that as any rumor whatsoever, because it's critical that lawyers have confidence in that confidentiality factor.
Right. Absolutely. And we don't, just to say it out loud explicitly, TLAP does not share information with discipline. Discipline does not come to TLAP to ask for any information. There's a complete Chinese wall there, and that it is respected by all the parties. There's no ever even any attempts to penetrate that. So it truly is, the confidentiality is highly respected by members of the bar, by the state bar, and by discipline and the board of law examiners and all the different parties and players that are in the legal profession and its governance.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge.
Well, you mentioned the Institute for Wellbeing and Law, and I omitted introducing you as having been the founder of that. And I believe you told us before we started recording back in 2006. Tell us about the Institute and what it does. And I mean, it seems like it's a kind of a self-explanatory title, but just talk about the Institute and your role in that.
I would love to, because the development of this and the arc of its creation really tracks along with the development of the well-being movement in the United States, which is well-being and law movement in the United States, which has really grown to become, is becoming a global movement. So in 2016, the LAP community finally had some good data out of some national studies that showed us definitively the disproportionate rates of alcohol use, disordered alcohol use, and behavioral health problems such as depression and anxiety among the legal population. So there were a variety of national bar associations who look at these types of issues, the LAPs, the NOBC, the Bar Council, et cetera. And we got together and said, okay, we have this window of opportunity. We finally have good data. We have an opportunity to do something about this. And so at that point in time, we created the National Task Force on Lawyer Wellbeing, and we wrote a report to the profession, and it contained 44 recommendations to the different stakeholder groups. Because what we looked at and what we're wanting to do is create a culture change in the profession. So that report really did not focus on making recommendations to individual lawyers. We exist to bring about systemic change and cultural change to the profession. And so we wrote this report to the different stakeholder groups. And when I say that, I mean the judges, the regulators or bar counsel, the law student community, et cetera, to give you a sense when I say stakeholder groups. And our biggest fear is that that would report, as they often do, would sit on a shelf and nobody would pick it up. And it was the exact opposite. I will tell you, everything that we have tried since that has just been met with open arms, with open doors. And we really have been off to the races. Immediately upon publishing that in 2017, the Conference of Chief Justices endorsed it. And immediately after that, the American Bar Association did. And so we started, a big piece of our work was to start creating state task forces on well-being and law around the country. So looking at this on a state-by-state initiative to check out what are the different policies, practices, procedures, culture within our state that may be a drain on lawyer, law student, judicial well-being. And so to date, we have over 30 states that have done just that. So we saw over time continuing interest and growth in this area, and including starting our own podcast, The Path to Lawyer Wellbeing. And so we've been doing that now for a few years, but everything that we turned our hand to was met with a great interest. And so ultimately, about a year and a half ago, we decided we could not, this band of loosely organized, passionate volunteers just couldn't keep up with the work that was being demanded from us. And so we created a think tank, the Institute for Wellbeing and Law, which is at lawyerwellbeing.net, if folks want to check that out. And our mission is really around that cultural and systemic change in the profession, such as the well-being and the considerations for the humanity of the participants in the profession become a priority for the profession.
Do you feel like those conversations have accelerated over the last couple of years with everything that's kind of happened around COVID and whatnot?
Absolutely. They have really taken off. When we started in speaking and going around the country, sharing this information, we really saw that there was still a lot of stigma that attached to these topics and a hesitancy to speak about them publicly. Just from around the stigma that still attaches to behavioral health disorders, which is, you know, amazing because these are medical diagnoses, but we still feel like there's some level of shame around for people who experience these issues. So people don't want to talk about it. They don't want to ask for help. And that's the world we found ourselves in 2017. Well, along comes the pandemic and all the societal unrest that has occurred in 2020. And we have seen a tremendous drain on the well-being, the behavioral health of members of our profession, such that the stigma around it, of talking about it, about these topics, has really dissipated over the past few years. We don't really see that anymore. And we see a true desire from, we'll just talk about the big law sector, to dig in and address these issues for the people that make up their firms. And even though the majority of the profession is not employed through big law, they still tend to drive the culture. And so we're seeing in the largest firms in the globe a real focus around these topics, such that they're creating well-being committees, directors of well-being that are being situated or positioned along with their DEI directors, diversity, equity, and inclusion directors, et cetera. And so a real concerted effort to address these. And so seeing that when we can get these, when big law steps into the space, that starts to create more conversation. Over the past few years, there's been a large number of articles on these topics in the legal media, a lot more coverage. And so just, again, eases the conversation and makes it more open for us to talk about it, to think mm-hmm. about it, and figure out what some of the solutions are.
You know, we've heard from judges about how the pandemic was sort of, we made a 100-year advance in technology and in law directly attributable to the pandemic. So it seems like there's been a similar effect with respect to the mindset of attorney well-being. Do you think that if we hadn't had the pandemic, would we be making these same advances, do you think?
We would not at the same rate. And I can say that we would with confidence. If you look at the demographics and the changing demographics of the legal profession, and you look at who is starting to move out of the profession at the higher age levels and who is coming in particular. So you look at the generations that are starting to enter the legal profession right now, these young people are not in any way hesitant to talk about these issues. And in fact, what we're seeing from studies is that these younger lawyers are more interested in things like work-life balance than they are with compensation levels. They're more willing to talk about it. They're putting it out front that this is what they want their life to be like as a lawyer. This is what they expect out of their employer. And so inherently, just with the passage of time, as we see this new generations come to the helm of the legal profession, it's going to change. So we're here, I mean, to help accelerate mm-hmm. that. And certainly the pandemic, unfortunately, has had an accelerant effect as well.
Well, and that's, you know, one of the kind of criticisms I think I've heard of from people on this issue is that some groups are maybe sort of throwing a Band-Aid approach of, you know, here's a link to you mindfulness podcast or, you know, something like that when it's not really addressing the systemic problems. But it sounds like y'all are working to change it on both levels.
Right. I mean, we do provide programming around well-being topics that are available for individual lawyers, but the real meat and potatoes of what we're trying to do is to develop strategies for legal employers, for example, mm-hmm. to instill greater, better policies, practices, and procedures. We have an initiative right now with the Conference of Chief Justices and the National Center for State Courts to develop a variety of programming, materials, recommendations, policies for the judicial community. So what can judges do to promote their own well-being? And not just judges, but also court personnel and staff who have really been through, everybody has, but have really been through the ringer with the pandemic and all the changes that that has brought.
Yeah, the judges, I think, get lost in this conversation sometimes. And they're unique in the sense that they're even more isolated. They're generally more isolated in their day-to-day than lawyers are, because lawyers can't have conversations with lawyers about the cases and things like that that ordinarily would help them process, right? And so just like all the lawyers, they during the pandemic were left with, you know, having to hold court over Zoom. And we're feeling even more isolated than usual. And so I'm really glad to hear that you all are addressing judicial well-being and mental health in this process too, because I think it winds up being an afterthought all too often.
Yeah. And I think one thing, Todd, that you mentioned there, the isolation, and that is such a driver of poor behavioral health, physical health too, but around just mental health. And there was a study conducted a couple of years ago around loneliness and looking at the different professions. And I don't know if you saw that, but I give you one guess to guess where lawyers ranked in that scale. And yes, we're number one. We are the loneliest professionals. Sounds like that'll be a song or something. But
the loneliest profession. Yeah.
We are. We are the loneliest professionals. And then I would say, given what, you know, judges are dealing with and just the constructs of their office and their duties and the rules, they are even lonelier than lawyers. And that is a real driver of depression, anxiety, and it can open the door. My years of being working at a lab can open the door for anybody to begin to abuse substances when you are cut off and denied these really essential human relationships that we need to function well. So the judiciary really takes a hit in that regard.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today. Let's kind of switch over a little bit to sort of some individual advice. You know, we talk about individual lawyers and we talk about law firms. I mean, what are some things that you are seeing or advice that you have for them in ways to sort of enhance well-being and kind of think about cultural change?
Sure. So let's start with the legal employers and what I would suggest there. And again, under the idea, the model that particularly the bigger law firms tend to drive cultural change and what we're seeing there, and that the idea that some of these practices will trickle down to other firms, to medium-sized firms. And then, of course, when you're dealing with solo and small firms, that's a whole different matter. And we can take that up in a different conversation or some questions. But with the larger firms, what we're recommending and we're seeing them do is to create a structure where this is embedded within the firm. So that means creating a well-being committee or whatever they might decide they want to call that. Have it a dedicated space and time to look at these issues. And probably the most important piece of advice around that is where you situate that committee within the structure and the hierarchy of the firm. So it's critical that you have people who are in leadership that are part of that, who are leaders of that, because people in the firm, when you want to change culture, that's one of the hardest things you can do. And so that's only going to occur when you signal to your staff that this is an important consideration to the leadership. And so they have to be there. The emails that come out about maybe some well-being programming needs to come from the leaders on that committee or within the firm. When I go to speak to firms, I always ask, could you please have someone in leadership or your CEO just introduce me? Because what, again, that signals that this is important and of value to the firm. So having a structure that's going to look at this with a regular basis and making sure that it is well aligned within the structure of the firm and that you have leadership's direct involvement with that. So that's a piece of it. The next of it is start looking at what are the policies and practices within the firm that may be impacting the well-being of our lawyers. So there's these policies and practices, and then there's the direct programming. So I think where we can get off track is a lot of people think that when they think well-being, wellness, that sort of thing, that's fun runs, right? That's, We have the dogs come, the therapy dogs come, and we get to, that's lovely, but it doesn't move the dial. So it's important to, you can do those things, but please don't stop there. In fact, don't start there. What you need to do is take a look at just that really nitty gritty, boring stuff. What do your personnel policies say about, let's give you a hypothetical. And this is something that firms are seeing across the country. More and more people are coming to HR with severe mental health let's just say breakdowns, people that are no longer able to function in their job, that have gotten sort of beyond the pale of where they should go in their mental health. And so if you have somebody that is experiencing that in your firm's ranks, ask the question, would that person know who to go talk to? Would they know what our firm's policies are around asking for leave? Do they know if they want to leave, take 30 days, how do they get back in? How do they get on-ramped back in? What is the reintegration process? How is this, will this be treated in regards to the confidentiality within the firm? And if you are opaque about those issues and those questions, people are not going to come forward and ask for help. And we're not going to change the stress of the legal profession. I don't think we'd want to. That's some of the things that lawyers thrive on. But we know these issues are going to come up. And so the whole issue here is not necessarily, we can prevent them when we can, but when it happens, we need to let people, we need to have the resources available, and we need to have a clear path, because there's nothing that a lawyer cares about more than his or her reputation, right? And we still have stigma around these things. And so we have to be explicitly clear of what people need to do to get help, how they'll be treated, and how they will be brought back into the firm. And if you don't have that transparency and clarity, people are going to continue to hide until they just can no longer function as lawyers. And we see those cases in the legal media where someone has taken their own life. And we know that that is the worst case scenario. And we know that it happens with some frightening regularity across the profession in the United States. So let's get ahead of that. You know, let's start pulling those people out of the river that have fallen in and figure out all the different strategies we can to keep them from falling into the river. So just this transparency on how to get help is a huge issue. And so there's that piece right there. There is looking at what are we doing around prevention and making sure we're not just paying lip service to it. So in a firm, one way you can start embedding the emphasis on well-being and behavioral health is to embed this within your annual review process. So do you have a module or a section when you're going through an annual review or whatever your review rate of review process is to address that? Let's see what that lawyer is doing. Did they take vacation or did they bank it all? Or what are their utilization rates of, you know, the well-being programming that you're doing? How are they doing? What is their view on how the firm is doing? But create a space where this is going to be structured and consider giving some sort of priority, bonus points, something to people that score well in that, on that sort of, I'll say, a module on their annual review. And so again, here we're creating the space for the conversation. We're creating a system to let people know this is important, and it's tied directly to your performance review. A word about vacation. It is, when you look at the studies around people, this is just so basic, people that take vacation and who don't. And then you look at their, you survey them around their sense of just, it's called subjective well-being. How do they feel that they're doing? Are they thriving or not? And there is a direct correlation between the number of days you take on your vacation and your sense of subjective well-being. And so if we can make within a firm that we value people taking the vacations, that we want you to rest and rejuvenate and then come back refreshed so you can do it all over again. So being able to send that message and create those processes within the firm is a way to move the dial on this. And it really, the things that I've told you right now don't cost the firm any money. So that's a bonus.
I love that description and almost a checklist of things that firms can and should be doing if they really are serious about prioritizing well-being. One thing you said early on was in terms of the structure, that it needed to be treated on par with the diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives that we see across the board in so many firms these days. I think that gives us a real sense of how seriously firms would be treating lawyer well-being, because, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion, or DEI, is very, very common across the board, especially in the big law firms. And I know I have read and seen well-being initiatives in those same firms, but I think if you to frame it that way, I think gives us a sense of how important it is, because law firms think that DEI is very important. And so, you know, one question maybe that a young lawyer ought to ask themselves when they go into looking for a permanent position in a law firm is, well, you know, how is well-being being treated by these firms? And I think that, and I see from, you know, we're pretty active on Twitter. And one nice thing about that is we get to see what young lawyers think a lot. And it is interesting that there does seem to be some cultural change, at least among the younger set. They are treating this as being very important. They're making choices of where they go to work. If law firms, you know, have a reputation as being just a sweatshop that just is just going to churn you out, I think people are making those lifestyle decisions. And even calling it a lifestyle decision sort of has a negative connotation, right? Because they're seen as not necessarily wanting to work that hard. But I'm encouraged to hear, and really that's just resonated with me when you put this whole concept on par with DEI, is how seriously that law firms generally need to be taking this.
Right. My vision, very succinctly, is that you'll start going to these major law firms, the Am Law 100s, and you'll see they have DEI or diversity on the top of the buttons, you know, about their staff, there's news, there's DEI, and there'll be a button too for well-being. And so that's what, when we start seeing that, when we land on the homepage for a major law firm, I think that we will truly have arrived. And these initiatives are really, really important to the younger people that are coming through. I believe they do want to work hard. They also want to know that they're going to go to work to some place where their humanity is respected. And for me, that's what it really boils down to. Do we respect people as human beings? And another example of a policy that I would encourage employers to look at is, what are your expectations, explicit or implicit, around availability? So are you expected, if you get an email at 9 o'clock, are you expected to respond to that email regardless by 8 o'clock in the morning? And so a lot of the firms are starting to look at figuring out how to put some guardrails around that, institute some boundaries. Just some basic sanity. People have to get sleep. And if you cannot get enough sleep, and we also know lawyers are the legal profession is sleep deprived too, that is an accelerant around these behavioral health issues. Just everything, and physically too, starts to fall through the floor when we are chronically sleep deprived. So how can we do that? So do we have a policy? What are the supervisors of associates and staff telling people around this? And even more important than anything else, than policies, than what people say, it's what people do. And it's what the leaders do. So the leaders of the firm need to get out in front of this and be vocal. They need to talk about it. And they need to walk the walk. I would love to see law firm leaders take their vacations and let people know, and even send out an email saying, I will not be available during, you know, this period on my vacation. I'm going to block out some time that I'm not going to be, you can't reach me. And sending that signal that it's okay, that will shift actual behavior. Then we start walking the walk and not just talking the talk.
Gosh, it just takes me back to the beginning of my career, you know, when as a young lawyer in a large law firm, those sort of expectations were, it was not expected. I was around when the first set of BlackBerries came out. And I know Jody at one point owned a BlackBerry, although I think he maybe got his much later than I did, because he's a few years younger than me. But I just remember thinking, oh, this is great. I can check my email, you know, anytime, day or night. And here I am, you know, 25 years later, and it's like, I don't want to check my email anytime of the night, and no one should expect to reach me at 11 p.m. or to get a response. And so That totally resonates with me. I agree 100% that it does start at the top. I mean, a law firm can institute all these policies, but they really don't mean anything if there's no action behind them. And you're spot on, Bree, just from my perspective, that it really comes from leadership. If we see leadership doing the things that the law firm says are within expectations, it makes it so much easier for that brand new lawyer to follow suit and see that this is really how it is in the culture of this law firm. The firm is not only talking the talk, but you know, the leaders are showing us that it's walking the walk, because that's how these folks learn, you know, is through example.
That's
and
right.
I think one of the things that this younger generation now is really good at is seeing through facades. And so for a law firm who wants to adopt these policies, you know, maybe for client relations purposes, but doesn't intend to follow through, I don't think that's going to work out very well. Just my humble opinion.
Right. Right. I agree. Absolutely.
How much progress would you say we've made in the last few years on this? I mean, 10 years ago, I don't think this was something that was really talked about hardly at all. And now I feel like it's talked about a lot more, but how much actual progress do you feel like has been made?
We're starting to put our foot on the path. You know, we're as a profession, we're putting our foot down to begin the first steps on the path towards creating a culture change. And so, of course, that we all know that the most difficult piece is getting over the inertia and in this case, stigma, to be able to take that first step. And so we've done a lot of the hard part. We've got people to start talking about this. We have the legal media paying attention to it and writing about it regularly, which increases awareness. We have different groups starting to come online to look at this. I will tell you that just within the space of people providing programming around this has really exploded over the last few years, just people who come and speak and work on these topics for the legal profession is another indicator. But until we start seeing some of these policies, practices, rules changing, we won't start hitting our stride on that journey. An example of something that we're seeing, I'm going to move from the law firms just talking about rules, regulations for the governance of the legal profession. So an area that is really taking hold and a lot of changes are occurring around the country is with the admissions to the practice itself. So we know that there's a character and fitness component to the bar admission. What studies have shown us is that because law students have gotten the word through the water or the air, I guess, that they are going to be asked about their behavioral health history. And even though when I was the lab director, I had folks from the Board of Law Examiners come and stand up right next to me and say, we do not want to know if you go see a therapist because you broke up with your boyfriend, that sort of thing. I mean, they've been very clear, but when you talk to the students themselves, they will not access behavioral health supportive services of any sort out of this terror that they'll have to report it. Then they won't be admitted to the bar, that they'll never get a job, and they'll live under a bridge. And that's kind of like, or sleep on their parents' sofa for the rest of their life. And that's the thought process we have. And so what is happening around the country, now that we know that there really, from studies, there is really not a linkage between somebody having maybe experience of major depression in college with their ability to practice law, with their rate of discipline or malpractice, there's just no correlation there. So there's no reason to inquire about that. So states are increasingly changing those questions or taking them out all together. And we're seeing that across the country. So that's something, if we can change those questions around the character and fitness or remove them, what you do is then you make it okay for the law students to go and get help for that depression, for that progressing alcohol use disorder. And we want them to do that before they become members of the profession. we'd really like them to start working on it early and getting it under control. So that type of systemic change can really make a difference in how people move through the profession and their willingness to access help.
Do you have any advice for lawyers, whether younger or older lawyers, to kind of self-advocate for their own wellness or the wellness of their peers?
I believe it's vitally important for individual lawyers to develop an awareness about their own level of well-being. We know that this is a sort of, I think of it as a behavioral health hard hat area for the profession. I mean, it is in some way a danger zone for lawyers. We know this. And so what I have preached to law students in particular and young lawyers and lawyers across the board, that it is vital to develop your own self-care plan that you're going to implement and modify over the course of your career. If you're going to do this incredibly difficult work, high, sustained, chronic stress for 40 years or more, you must attend to your own health and have a plan, whatever that is. We're all experts on ourselves. So whatever may work. I mean, I think that that is one of the most essential pieces of advice that I can give to any person in the profession. To have a plan, to be regularly looking internally and assessing how am I doing? And if your well-being drops below what you think it should be, and you can recognize that by how are you feeling or how are you behaving towards other people? If that takes a dip, well, okay, the warning sign, the red lights come on. What am I going to implement to help bring me back up? I think a real strong strategy that I'm talk about a lot these days is making sure that we have opportunities for respite and rest that we're building in to these big pushes of work and effort that we have within the practice of law. So that's just some of the ideas.
I'll say it a little more bluntly to law students and young lawyers, you're not bulletproof. Sometimes you do have to, I like the rest and respite approach in the self-inventory and analysis. I'm sure that there are tools out there by which, let's just say, a law student can evaluate their own well-being. But one question I had as we were having this conversation was, what role should or do the law schools play in developing that self-awareness when it comes to well-being? Because, you know, you're in the situation where it's such an achievement-driven system, right? And, you know, oh, if I just study harder or if I just work harder, I'll do better than so-and-so on that final exam. So have you heard about any trends in and among the law schools? And what should the law schools be doing to help promote well-being at that stage of one's legal career?
Since the publication of that report in 2017, which included an array of recommendations to the law school community, this has really been taken to heart. And so we did a survey of law schools about 3 years ago to look at what's being implemented around the country. We heard from half of the law schools, and we saw that there really has begun efforts to implement well-being programming and strategies for that within the law schools. For example, well over a majority of the responding law schools have developed some sort of mindfulness or meditation programming that they can offer the students. So that's really valuable. That is sort of putting your toe in the water, though, around these issues. I think what we need to see, which is happening haphazardly, but needs to happen more consistently with the law schools, we get to leadership again, right? Mm-hmm. And who are the true leaders of the law firm? And that's the tenured professor faculty. And those women and men are on almost deity status, right? With the students there. And so for those professors to start taking into consideration what they can say to their students, if every course had at some point, even if it's 10 minutes by the professor, in a professional responsibility course, we ask for a full class where the professor stops and talks about what it is to be a lawyer, these formation issues for becoming a lawyer and how difficult it is and how the students need to pay attention to this would be incredibly valuable. If one of the leading professors in their part of their curriculum took 10 minutes out to say, this was a period of time in my legal career when I struggled and had a hard time, and this is what I did. And I want you to be thinking about this over the course of your 40 or 50 year career. That is golden. That takes almost no time and no money and will do more than anything else. The other thing we can do, and we can start looking at the ABA standards that are being modified, are mandates, you know, involve within the curriculum a certain number of hours around instruction on well-being issues. That's been contemplated by the ABA. They haven't gone there yet, and they may. So we can create these mandates, which will help, but really have the buy-in from the leadership, the top of the law schools, to create a space for this, to create a priority within the deans of student affairs, that this is an issue area that they really are going to talk about and do programming for their students.
Well, Jody asked you about how much improvement we had seen over the past 10 years and how you would describe us that progress. And you say we've put a foot on the path. I'm going to ask you to stare into your crystal ball for a minute. And I won't hold you to a firm prediction because I know how difficult that can be. But where do you see us, honestly, given your experience and what you see going on in the industry right now? How much progress should we expect to make in the next 10 years based on our current trajectory and the influence of the pandemic and accelerating that progress?
I think it's reasonable to expect, and I do predict, that we will have continued focus. This is not a flash in the pan. This is not a flavor of the month sort of thing, because it has struck a chord with members of the profession. And we also know, let's just get really honest here, it affects the bottom line for the practice. When we look at with the law firms, there is a direct business case here around profitability, basically. We're in the midst of the great resignation and this sort of brain drain and attrition and lateral frenzy within the legal profession. And so one of the ways that you can stem the tide of that is looking around well-being and understanding that when you have a firm, an employment setting that is in flux, like so many are right now, that is detrimental to the well-being of everybody. Mm-hmm. So with the direct connection of the dots between this and profitability, I do believe that it's going to be an ongoing concern. And I expect that we will increasingly see firms moving from what we're seeing in the AmLaw 100 down to even mid-sized firms to institute actual person or committee within the structure of the employer that's going to look at and address these issues. Perhaps it is a well-being director, perhaps it is a well-being committee as well, that you're going to start seeing infrastructure within law schools where they have people that are dedicated to this area, where you have state bar associations as well as local bar associations that will have well-being committees that are looking at this. And so we have implanted within the structure of the profession this focus, just like we have, you know, civil procedure is mm-hmm. a focus mm-hmm. that is implanted and embedded within the firm. And I believe we are starting to see that in the judiciary as well, where some of these higher level, like the National Center for State Courts and the national judicial organizations, are starting to build in a real focus around this too. So once it becomes institutionalized, we get it in policies and procedures and, you know, committee structure. That's what I think we're going to see, because that's definitely the trend. And that is going to help propel the well-being and law movement.
Well, Bree, as we wrap up, it's our tradition to always ask for a tip or a war story. And you've given some great tips. I don't know if you have more or if you have a war story you'd like to share, but we'd love to hear in closing.
Sure. I think when I was thinking about this for appellate lawyers, you know, I already talked about that law is the loneliest profession. And I think when you're in appellate law, it seems that the thought that you're going to spend even more time behind a computer screen and isolated. So I would say to your listeners to really think about and assess, how are you connecting with other people? What do you need? Are you an introvert? Probably. Or are you an extrovert? But even introverts need to have that human connection, or we stop functioning as well. We don't operate on the same level. Our resilience is not as strong, that ability to bounce back when we take hard knocks or do really hard things. And so when you have created a life and a career that is sort of avoids other people, my advice is to get out a piece of a pen and paper and write down the name of three people that bring a smile to your face. You know, this is somebody, maybe they were in your wedding. Maybe there's somebody that you haven't seen in a long time, but this person makes you smile, and reach out to that person. And I would say, send them an email and say, hey, let's get on a Zoom, or let's have a cup of coffee, and create a space for a face-to-face interaction, not Facebook messaging, not Twitter, you know, not just email, but, and do that. And you are, what you're doing is sort of banking some resilience. You're building your resiliency and your well-being capital by having these very positive, meaningful, important interactions. But if you just let it happen organically, we know what happens there, right? It just doesn't happen. We're too busy. So with great intentionality, create the space for those things to happen. And it'll put a smile on your face.
Exactly.
It certainly will. And that's really great advice, Bree. Thank you so much for that tip. And thanks again for being with us. We're just super grateful. You've given just a tremendous amount of information in our time together. And thanks for agreeing to come on the podcast. We really appreciate it.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you both.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.